Trading losses at J.P. Morgan Chase have surged in recent days, moving far beyond the initial number of $2 billion. We're joined now by Rolling Stone contributing editor Matt Taibbi, the author of numerous colorfully written articles on the major banks and of five books, including The Great Derangement and Griftopia. It's always a great pleasure to welcome you to our show, Matt.
Good to be here, Leonard.
There are reports that the initial trading loss of $2 billion at J.P. Morgan Chase is now expected to grow to $3 billion and could go as high as $4 billion. Why is the scale of these losses growing?
Well, there's a couple of things here. First of all, these are derivatives trades, so they're extremely complicated. And they also, as we saw with something like AIG, there is an ability with these trades to set off a kind of chain reaction of losses. So it's extremely difficult to calculate how big the loss actually is, which should give people pause when the company itself doesn't know how bad the problem is.
And how quickly it's going to escalate. Jamie right. Dimon, the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, said that the loss could double over a few quarters, and now they seem to be happening over a few hours.
Right. This isn't something where they can just open up the books and take out a calculator and figure it out over a couple of minutes. These trades are extraordinarily complex. They're very difficult to unwind, and they depend on a lot of different shifting factors. So it's sort of like trying to predict the weather. It's just this, there's a lot of different things going on.
But I was also reminded of the famous line attributed to Senator Everett Dirksen, a billion here, a billion there. Pretty soon you're talking about real money. Will these losses have much of an impact on the overall health of a bank as big as J.P. Morgan Chase?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. J.P. Morgan Chase is supposedly going to be $19 billion in the black this year. So if you look at it that way, no. But, I mean, how much money have they lost in market capitalization just in the last week, and their share price going down? And also, again, we don't know the extent of the losses yet. But that's not even really the issue here. The issue here is that this is sort of like a Three Mile Island incident. It didn't blow up Pennsylvania, but it could have, and that's what we're really worried about is the potential threat to the public treasure by something like this.
Well, the man behind this, the man who lost all that money, is also credited with earning J.P. Morgan Chase.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Bruno Ixell in London. He was credited with earning $100 billion.
For himself, yes.
Oh, yeah, that's just himself.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, he's been credited with earning a lot of money for the bank. So is this just seen as the cost of doing business?
Well, what people have to understand is that J.P. Morgan Chase is essentially the world's biggest hedge fund. The bank itself has well over, I think it's $2 trillion in assets. And this particular wing of the company is managing something like $300 billion. So it's the biggest gambling fund in the world, I think. So they're constantly, up or down enormous sums at any given moment. The problem is Chase is a federally insured depository institution, and that's really what the problem is. We were never intending to guarantee this sort of activity.
But this money isn't going to be paid for by the FDIC.
No.
On the other hand, we're talking about a huge pot of money, and some of it comes from this place, some of it comes from that place. We've had you on the show to talk about Goldman Sachs and Bank of America, among other institutions. Are we just cycling through all the banks?
Well, sooner or later, they all come up. I mean, they're all essentially involved in the same kinds of activities. Chase, for some reason, after 2008, got the reputation as being the quote-unquote good bank because it wasn't involved in as many high-profile scandals as something like Goldman Sachs. But it wasn't really a deserved reputation. Chase was involved directly in probably the biggest financial disaster in the last decade, which was Jefferson County, Alabama, which ended up being bankrupted when bank officials literally bribed local officials to take on a toxic swap deal that bankrupted the whole county. They were involved last year. They got fined $228 million for municipal bid rigging in 25 different states. There were something like 80 counts in that case. So Chase has been involved in a lot of things. It just hasn't gotten this kind of bad press.
Now, I love Chase because they have machines in all the Duane Reade outlets. Should I be moving to some other bank, or am I going to be embarrassed no matter where I go?
I was a Chase customer myself, and I'm moving to a credit union also. So it's actually a real problem. When I ask people who are on Wall Street where should I do my banking, they kind of scratch their head because there isn't a good answer.
Many commentators in the media have said that in this case, the fact that the bank is so big is a good thing. It allows them to absorb this massive trading loss without too much trouble. In this sense, is there a positive case for too big to fail?
I think that's a very naive way of looking at it. The problem is that this company is that big. If it wasn't a big company, then it wouldn't matter to us if they were making these trades, because we wouldn't the specter of having to go beyond the FDIC reserve to bail out the company wouldn't be looming over all of us.
But defenders of the bank's practices point out that the public won't suffer, just the bank's stockholders.
But that's not true. If the bank goes under, if J.P. Morgan Chase were
– it's not going to go under.
Well, why not? Bear Stearns went under.
But they bought Bear Stearns.
With the help of the federal government. And Lehman Brothers went under and AIG went under. I mean, nobody foresaw that any of these companies would go out of business. Chase's biggest competitors, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, they recently
Citibank.
Citibank, they were all recently downgraded, and their debt is trading just above junk level right now. So maybe Chase survives, but the all of these banks are kind of hanging by a thread. And if any one of them goes, we have no choice. We have to step in and rescue them because the effect on the economy would be too catastrophic.
The New York Times recently noted that many of the positions held by the bank are highly illiquid, making them difficult to value for regulators and the bank itself. So no one really knows how much money is sloshing around out there.
Right, and the bank itself recently changed its calculation of what its VAR, its value at risk, was. When this whole error surfaced, Jamie Dimon came out and suddenly said, oh, our calculations, our previous formula was incorrect, so our VAR is actually twice what we said it was last quarter. And that's what's so terrifying about this, is that it's so difficult in the age of derivatives to get an accurate handle on the accounting of these companies. They're just too big, and derivatives are too difficult to calculate.
And don't they usually calculate on the most optimistic side?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And the reason they do that is because our regulators don't force them to be more conservative.
Although the size of the bet taken by the bank in this case may be problematic, didn't the fact that information on the bank's position had leaked also play a role in the loss of the money?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, a lot of it was the bank's own fault, from what I understand, by letting this get out. And there were news stories about this gigantic position that this London whale had, which apparently rallied the market to get on the other side of the trade. And
so people are benefiting? They smell blood and they're
right.
Making money because of this?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I think there's not going to be a lot of love lost for J.P. Morgan Chase because, typically it goes the other way. This bank has so much capital, and it's kind of like a poker player that has a huge stack. When they get somebody on the ropes, they can just kind of lean on the other players until they go out of business.
So J.P. Morgan sits atop the entire financial system at this point?
It's one of the – if it's – in the United States, it's really Chase and Wells Fargo are the two super too big to fail companies that are still relatively healthy.
Because in 2010, the New York Times wrote, neither Goldman Sachs nor any other firm can match J.P. Morgan's breadth of overall strength.
Well, Goldman Sachs doesn't even compare to Chase's in terms of its potential danger to the economy. And Goldman Sachs, even though it has a commercial bank holding company charter from the government and is taking money from the Fed as if it were a real bank, it is not a bank. It doesn't have, trillions of dollars of deposits. It's just an investment bank. So this is a much more dangerous company.
My guest on today's Backstory is Matt Taibbi. We're talking about the situation at J.P. Morgan Chase. Do we fully understand the trades that Bruno Iskell engaged in that created this mess?
I don't totally understand them. I have a general idea from what I understand. They haven't leaked all the details yet. From what I gather, it reminds me a little bit of what happened at AIG. AIG also had a small unit that was based in London called AIGFP, and that unit was suddenly decided to go long betting on mortgages. They were selling credit protection. In this case, it wasn't mortgages. They were selling credit protection against corporate debt. And again, this sort of unit within a bank, its typical position is to be short. They're hedging. Banks themselves are usually long the entire economy because they're lending, they're trying to stimulate businesses. These units within these banks are typically on the other side. They're trying to hedge. In this case, they went long, and that's why it created this gigantic mess.
Now, the culprit usually seems to be in some satellite unit. There was a major problem. Was it Barclays? I can't remember now. Some years back, where
Barings,
Barings, where the guy was in Singapore or Hong Kong,
right,
and caused the trouble. Do you think it's because they're not in the main office and people aren't watching them every day that these kinds of things can get out of hand?
Well, there's a couple of things at work here. Number one, they're not in the main office. They're in London, just like AIG. They're not right there. But more importantly, these trades are extremely complicated. And again, even after they've discovered the problem, it takes them a long time to understand them. In the case of AIG, it was an insurance company, and the people in the parent company literally didn't get what these trades were all about. And I think, you know, something similar is going on here.
Don't credit default swaps play a role in this story? According to Bloomberg, Iskil had been earning a lot of money just doing that, hearing so much in a single year that people were just happy to let him do what he was doing without paying much attention to it.
Yeah, that's what he was doing. Is he was selling credit default swaps. He was. It's almost like an insurance policy.
And where does the money that they're betting on these things come from? Are they playing with depositors' money?
I'm not really clear on that, but clearly they're drawing from the overall. I mean, again, Chase has over $2 trillion in assets. They have all this money under deposit. They also have access to the federal, the discount window. And according to the Fed audit that happened after Dodd-Frank, they had access to something like $390 billion of low-cost, below-market emergency loans from the Fed. So all these too-big-to-fail companies, they have essentially a limitless supply of free or almost free government cash that keeps them liquid, and they go out and they make loans in the economy and they do things like this, and that's generally where the money comes from.
Hasn't there been some debate about whether the kind of trading that Iskil engaged in is in violation of the Volcker Rule?
Yes. In fact, they're arguing that this was technically a hedge, and hedging is exempted under the conception of the Volcker Rule as it is right now. The Volcker Rule hasn't been implemented. It's been delayed till 2014. But to me, that actually underscores the problem with the Volcker Rule, which is that it was riddled with so many different exemptions and loopholes even before it passed that it was really meaningless by the time they got it into law.
Although it does run 300 pages or so. But Jamie Dimon is still defending his lobbying to keep it as weak as possible.
Oh, absolutely. I tell this story a lot, but when I covered the negotiations for Dodd-Frank, there were so many banker lobbyists in Washington that I literally didn't have a place to sit when I was waiting for an interview with one of the senators in the banking committee. There were thousands of them in Washington, and they were all pushing to create those 300 and 400 page exemptions in these rules.
So they're spending millions of dollars.
Yes.
We don't add that on to the $2 billion or the $3 billion, just J.P. Morgan Chase probably spent many millions.
J.P. Morgan Chase, I think I read somewhere, spent something like $7 million just on the issue of the
and that is my money.
Well, yeah, exactly. It is your money, right?
Well, I better go take it out now before they hire another lobbyist. My guest on Backstory today is Matt Taibbi. We're talking about the situation at J.P. Morgan Chase. It is the largest bank holding company in the United States. Its assets, what did you say,
$2.2 trillion, something like that, yeah.
And has its size and power grown in the aftermath of the financial crisis? Has it grown over the last years?
Yes, absolutely, yeah. Chase is one of the companies that directly benefited from all the chaos in 2008 because they with government help, they swallowed up Bear Stearns first, and then Washington Mutual next. So they had an enormous foray into the investment banking world, and then they also massively grew their depository wing.
Jamie Dimon says he doesn't want federal assistance, but the bank also received almost $390 billion in government-backed loans.
Right.
Why so much for such a successful institution?
Because they all got it. Again, that was the Fed audit that disclosed that number. As part of Dodd-Frank, we got a little window into how much money the Fed has been giving out. Over just a 2-year time period, the Fed lent out $16 trillion in emergency loans to Wall Street, and all these banks got enormous sums of below market or essentially free cash from the government. This is what people don't understand about modern finance. They say, oh, these are private companies. Well, yeah, they're private companies, but they're getting their money for free from the government, and then they go and lend it to us at 5 or 10 or 20% as credit cards or mortgages or whatever.
And when Bruno Iskell is working in London, is he working under international laws or is he working under U.S. laws?
You know, that's kind of a gray area. I'm not really sure about that. I think, well, again, there are both international and domestic laws that apply to all these different transactions. You know, the Basel Accord is going to govern how much capital we have to retain before we do those kinds of trades, and that's an international rule. The Volcker Rule, on the other hand, would be a domestic rule that they would have to abide by.
Elizabeth Warren has called for reinstituting the Glass-Steagall Act, but most people don't think that's likely.
Well,
would this have been eliminated? Would this have been possible if Glass-Steagall was still in effect?
No. Glass-Steagall, and again, conservatives always are complaining that the Volcker Rule was too complicated, has too many pages. They always cite that 2,300-page number. But the Glass-Steagall Act was incredibly simple. All it says is an investment bank can't be a commercial bank, can't be an insurance company. And we had that rule. It worked perfectly for half a century.
J.P. Morgan is all three?
J.P. Morgan is all three. Citigroup is all three. And that creates this inherent danger of the economy.
Years ago, when I asked the former Washington Post editor-in-chief, Ben Bradley, why his paper hadn't covered the savings and loan scandal as aggressively as Watergate, he said that when people read complicated financial stories, their eyes glaze over.
Mm-hmm.
Is that why it's so difficult to get people engaged in issues like this?
Absolutely.
Because I know when I try to understand it, the minute I see the word derivatives, I move over to the next story.
Yeah, people immediately lose attention when you start talking about these issues. I talked to a congressman who sits on the Financial Services Committee just a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about Dodd-Frank, and he said that I have never once gone home and had somebody say to me, we need to have derivatives traded on open exchanges, even though this is a crucial issue that affects literally everybody. Our gas prices might be 15% higher because of things like this, but nobody understands it, and it's just too complicated. It's too boring for people.
And I've often heard it said that in the lead-up to the 2008 crisis, many bankers didn't understand the products that they were selling.
Absolutely, especially these derivatives trades. I remember talking to people who essentially said a lot of these traders had math geeks who they'd import from various parts of the world, from India and China, and would put them in back offices, and they would cook up the formulas for these credit default swaps and these synthetic credit default swaps, and the traders themselves often didn't understand the math involved in this, that's why it led to these miscalculations and errors.
How close is the administration to J.P. Morgan Chase's head, Jamie Dimon? He describes himself as kind of a Democrat, but the Times called him Obama's favorite banker.
Right. Yeah, I was just going to say that a couple of years ago. The Times gave him that description. Well, clearly Obama is not getting the same kind of money from Chase or from the rest of the Wall Street banks this time around that he got in 2008 when he was heavily supported by Wall Street. They favored him over McCain by a factor of almost 2-1, or more than 2-1.
But why? He hasn't been calling for stringent oversight, has he?
It's kind of a mystery to me why they're not giving him the money this time, because typically, you know, why did they fund him in 2008? Not because they liked him better than John McCain. It's because they thought he was going to win. And I think if you looked at the Vegas odds in 2008 in the summer, Obama was about a 7-3 favorite to win the election, and that was exactly the same ratio that Wall Street was betting was donating money.
So they must think Mitt Romney's going to win this time.
Maybe. I just can't fathom what it is. I think they're upset about Dodd-Frank. I think they're trying to pressure the administration on some key issues. We've seen that it worked with the Jobs Act, for instance, which was a major deregulatory bill. That happened with a lot of Democratic help. And I think they're trying to get the Democrats to step up to the plate on things like the Volcker Rule and the Jobs Act before the election happens.
In an appearance on The View, President Obama addressed the trade. Let's take a listen.
J.P. Morgan is one of the best managed banks there is. Jamie Dimon, the head of it, is one of the smartest bankers we got. And they still lost $2 billion in counting, precisely because they were making bets in these derivative markets. We don't know all the details yet. It's going to be investigated. But this is why we passed Wall Street reform. The whole point was, even if you're smart, you can make mistakes.
New York Magazine called this a new Mean Girls phase in the two men's relationship. Was that a backhanded criticism, and is it likely to change much?
I actually think the opposite. I think that was an incredibly nice thing to say about Chase under the circumstances. For Barack Obama to say that Chase is one of the best run banks in the country after they were fined $228 million for municipal bid rigging after Jefferson County, these are major felonies that this company's been involved with, and the president glosses it over in a major address. I thought that was a help to them.
Well, on the other hand, he was withholding a bit of confidence in them. He wasn't giving them a total endorsement.
Sure.
MIT economist Simon Johnson called for a fully public investigation of the bank and wrote recently in the New York Times, quote, "Given the strong political connections between J.P. Morgan Chase and the Obama administration, it would also be better to have an investigation led by a completely independent counsel."
I think that's true. I also think that there was a growing tendency and a movement towards just simply breaking up these companies. Forget about investigating them. We just have to break them up. They're too big. This incident, it's not really about derivatives trading. That's not really the issue. The issue is the size and interconnectedness of these banks and the danger they pose, and that's not going to change.
Well, how do you break them up?
Well, that would be an enormous chore. It would take years and years and years of political and logistical work to get it done, but it has to be done. There was an amendment that was as part of the Dodd-Frank bill, the Brown-Kaufman amendment, that would have mandated the breakup of companies once they reached a certain size and level of interconnectedness. And that amendment was just recently reintroduced. We've seen the Chicago Fed, the Dallas Fed, a lot of prominent would-be quote-unquote conservatives start to talk about this issue as a sort of matter of national security, and I think there's momentum moving towards that now.
On the other hand, in the old days, it was frustrating to go to another city and not be able to find your New York bank, or if you were from Chicago, to not find your Chicago bank, and one-stop banking really can be quite convenient. On the other hand, it has led to these behemoths, obviously. The FBI is doing an investigation. That would suggest that they see some criminal activity here.
That was a bit mystifying to me. I think from talking to other people in the last couple of days, what they might be looking at is the disclosure issue. How early did they know that this problem existed, and how long did they take before they disclosed this to the public and their shareholders? There might be an accounting issue that they might be looking at. I don't think, to me, this isn't so much a criminal issue. It might be, but you know, it doesn't compare to the other major criminal issues that the banks have been involved with, like the securities fraud and the mortgage markets. This is more. What this is really more about is the inherent danger of the system, if it's done legally.
We should point out that nobody's going to jail for any
right.
of these things. But it is interesting that we have seen shareholder revolt in England, and shareholders
Citigroup.
Had an opportunity, and Citigroup, yeah, mm-hmm. although did heads roll as a result of that?
No, but they rejected Vikram Pandit, the CEO's compensation package, which was something that just would not have happened a couple of years ago. So people and apparently even the shareholder meeting 2 days ago with Chase was a lot more contentious than it would have been, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago.
Still, the leading critics voted to keep Jamie mm-hmm. Dimon in as both CEO and chairman,
mm-hmm.
and they are not cutting his compensation package at all.
Well, no. I mean, the bank is still enormously profitable, and they're going to be $19 billion in the black this year, so you're not likely to see a huge amount of shareholder discontent yet, but I think the climate is definitely changing there.
So where does the $19 billion profit come from?
Well, again,
similar kinds of trading?
Well, this unit accounted for 25% of Chase's profits. So this again,
so this is the cost of doing business.
This is the cost of doing business, and this is the world's largest hedge fund, and they do make an enormous amount of money, but really, the issue with these too big to fail banks is A, they have an inherent competitive advantage in the marketplace because everybody knows they'll never be allowed to fail. So it's cheaper for them to borrow money than it is for a smaller regional bank. If you know that Chase is always going to pay back that loan, why wouldn't you loan them money? So they're able to get their money cheaper. They're able to get money almost for free from the government through the discount window and emergency lending. So cost of capital is everything in banking. If your cost of capital is nothing, and then there's all these other ways they make money. I mean, they're getting money for free from the government. They're lending it back to the government in the form of T-bills at 3%. And that's just simply – it's a license to print money. If you're borrowing at zero and then selling it back to the government at 3, I'd like to get that deal. And so – These companies, they have a number of different ways that they can make money that's relatively risk-free.
Do you think that Jamie Dimon is protected to some degree because he doesn't come across as arrogant as some of the other heads, Blankfein, for example?
I think he's been a lot more media savvy.
He was on Meet the Press, and he apologized.
He did apologize. He didn't. What he didn't do is exactly what Blankfein did after Goldman got in a lot of trouble, which was call up a reporter and tell him that I'm doing God's work. A lot of these guys are incredibly out of touch. I think Dimon is also to an extent, but less so than some of the other.
Well, he's been one of the loudest agitators against regulation. Will he be taken less seriously now?
He just doesn't carry the same weight probably on the Hill that he did before this happened. Again, the reputation of Chase before this latest fiasco was, well, regardless of what they're into, Chase is a well-run company that makes a lot of money, unlike all these other miscreants like Bank of America that are continually on the edge of a bailout. Chase, at least, has never demanded this giant government surplus, but that might change now.
Just one more thing. On another topic, recently in a blog post which asked in its headline, "Is this the most boring election ever?" you wrote, "The apathy factor in American presidential politics has seemingly never been higher." Why do you think the public is so turned off by this race?
I think there are a lot of different things in play here. Number one, I think there's a general consensus, especially with issues like this. This brings out the fact that there isn't a whole lot of difference between, say, Barack Obama and Mitt Romney on a lot of the issues that are galvanizing, say, the Occupy protests or the Tea Party.
Well, if Barack Obama came down a little harder on the banks since they're no longer supporting him, mm-hmm. wouldn't that make the election a little more exciting?
I think it would. I think it definitely would. And I wonder why the administration hasn't gone that route, because there's a lot of political hay to be made by going in that direction and just doing the right thing. Even if they just did a couple of high-level prosecutions of some people who committed fraud and manipulated the markets, they would be enormously popular. But they hesitate for some reason to do that.
You also predicted that Obama was going to win. I don't make predictions because it's apparent that the election is still 6 months away.
Right.
So many things can happen. We can have a terrorist attack. Mm-hmm. We can have some kind of a success. Gas prices can go down to $3 a gallon and whatever. Maybe unemployment figures will suddenly start looking a lot rosier or worse.
Mm-hmm.
And those are all unpredictable. And they will really be playing a major role in the month or even 2 weeks leading up to the election. But I suspect other than that, people's minds are already made up. People know that they're going to vote for one of these candidates even now, and nothing really will change that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. You never really know, and you're absolutely right not to get into the predictions business. I shouldn't do that, but I just felt
Gene Dixon was always wrong. You know that.
But just going out, when I covered some of the campaign events this year, I've never seen less excitement about a potential front-running candidate than I've seen about Romney. My editor actually asked me to find somebody in a Romney audience who was psyched about Romney, not who didn't like the other candidates, but who was psyched about that candidate. And I just couldn't find that person. So I didn't think that boded well for the general election.
Matt Taibbi has been our guest on today's Backstory segment. We've been talking 99% about J.P. Morgan Chase, 1% about politics, but they're all interrelated, aren't they?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Thanks so much for being here again.
Thanks for having me.